Welcome to Advisor Go Radio. I'm Stephanie Sammons.
And this is Zach Miller.
So today, another edition of Advisor Go Radio. We've got a couple things, big things, going on in the news, wouldn't you say?
A lot of big news in the brokerage industry.
Yeah, so what's the latest?
So Sally is out at Bank America.
I just could not believe that. I saw it last night when I was reading some news and saw that her position has been eliminated. So that's interesting.
It says a lot about what Bank of America thinks of the whole wealth management division.
Yeah, you know, I know there are also issues around, you know, another a woman executive at the top of the ranks in the financial services industry, especially big brokerage, but that's always controversial. But I think the bigger question is, does the wealth management unit have a voice now? They don't have a leader, right?
Seems, again, these are industry-wide trends. And I think that the brokerage business is contracting still. This is another drop in that process.
I totally agree with you. It's interesting because does this mean, you know, that these wealth management units are just sort of going to get swallowed up by the banks, literally, to where they're glorified bankers, you know, offering investment products? I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see how the full service model evolves over the next 3 to 5 years.
Do you expect to see sort of just like an onslaught of people just leaving Merrill now?
I don't know. I would say that the top 20% of the reps there are very well off. They've always had a voice. So this, like I said, will be interesting if there is no direct leadership over wealth management, then you really have to wonder. If they don't continue to get to have a voice, then I could definitely see a shakeout happening. But I think overall the trend in the industry is moving to more of a hybrid or independent type model.
All right, fiduciary.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at margins have been shrinking substantially over the years. It's very difficult to – you've got to have – a lot of assets under management, really, to have a scalable business, especially in the full service world. So, I don't know. I think that the entrepreneurial advisors in the full service firms will figure out ways to continue to grow and gather assets and generate revenue off of those assets. And I don't know if the bottom 50% of advisors are going to be able to do that in a sustainable way over the long term.
And harder to replenish the ranks too, like bringing in new people.
Yeah, and I think that's the age-old problem. It's sort of a broken model that most of the wealth is managed by the above 50 demographic. So transitioning clients and wealth, just as we're witnessing, you know, the transition of wealth from the largest demographic out there, baby boomers, 76 million of them, same thing is going on inside of the full service, actually the entire financial services industry, right?
Yep.
The financial advisor population is a bit older. So, how do you successfully transition clients and assets without losing them? And,
well, again, it's probably just a succession issue, right? I mean, as families in turn pass their wealth off, advisors will have to, you know, bring in younger people to pass off their practices as well, right?
Yeah, true. But I don't know. I've seen that experiment fail many, many times.
Yeah.
You know, being in that industry in the full service world for 15 years, it's horizontal teams seem to work better than vertical teams, vertically structured teams. Lots and lots of breakups, you know. These advisors have great ideas and seem to be compatible and get together, and it's kind of like a marriage. It's a lot of hard work to be able to have a functional team And I don't know. I think it's a huge challenge for the industry.
We'll definitely keep our eyes on it. I mean, that's a huge, overwhelming trend here.
And then you've got the trainees that come into these programs, and you know, they're scraping to just survive, and the hurdles are just astronomical. But if they could solve this problem and figure out a way to hang on to the qualified, younger financial advisors who are really, really good at working with clients, and they know how to develop these relationships and manage assets and retain assets, then it could be quite successful. But right now, I just think the model is very broken. I've seen a lot of trainees come in and out, you know, within a 9-month period, who could have been really great financial advisors, but never had a chance to get off the ground.
One of my favorite reads is I go to registeredrep.com, and there's some message boards there. And yeah, obviously, most of the advisors are hiding their real identities.
Yeah,
but there's some amazing information there about some of these young guys coming in, experimenting, trying to build their practices off the ground, and some of the techniques they use.
Interesting.
Yeah, like some, you know, one guy basically did a diary where he was every day he was logging how many calls he made, how many doors he knocked on. This was a guy going out and just pounding the pavement, and he was building a practice. I mean, it was, you know, in his early 20s, and you know, he was producing $500,000, you know, by the end of the second year. So, you know, it was just interesting to watch because it was completely transparent.
Yeah, that's cool. And there are certainly that handful of advisors who come into the business who are going to do well regardless. But you just sit there and you see these big advisors hanging on to every nickel with regard to their assets under management. And so many clients are underserved and overcharged in a sense because they're not being taken care of. You know, that we were taught you focus on the top 20% of your business because that's where 80% of your revenue comes from. And I think that's true. But, you know, that leaves 80% of your clientele underserved, potentially. So there could be a lot of benefit to having a competent, younger in the business financial advisor come in and help with your practice. But advisors are just really touchy about that subject. They, at least in my experience, it's, again, it's just a big challenge. It's a problem to solve.
So one of these... You mentioned to me there was another big piece of news about some type of branding issue.
Yeah, so are you familiar with Linked FA?
Can you? A little bit. I don't know them very well.
Linked FA, and I don't know a lot about them, but they're essentially a closed social network for financial professionals and their clients. So what they have built is a platform where advisors can sign up and invite their clients to sign up and communicate just as you would on something like a Facebook or a LinkedIn perhaps. And apparently all of that communication it's monitored and it's FINRA compliant, essentially. Mm-hmm. They're complying with FINRA regulations within this network.
Okay.
So, you know, and they've been around a while. They raised, they went through a round of funding. They raised $3 million and maybe 6-9 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been slowly, you know, building out their platform and making it better. But apparently LinkedIn has challenged the Linked FA trademark back in October of 2010. We're just finding out about it. And not only that, but LinkedIn also tried to shut down their access to the API with LinkedIn.
So what's that all about? That's LinkedIn wanting to sort of own that business and not having someone sort of usurp it from them?
Yeah, I mean, the only way that these firms such as Socialware, okay, they are a compliance archiving solution for social media engagement, and Arcovi is another one. And by the way, we forgot to mention Arcovi is the sponsor of this podcast.
That's right.
And they do social media compliance for financial professionals and firms, and great little company. But anyway, these compliance archiving solutions have to have access to the APIs of the social networks in order to get the data, to archive it, to archive the activity and have it be monitored. So if LinkedIn's trying to close the door on that, there must be a real business threat here.
It just seems so anti-competitive. I mean, they built these APIs so that sort of niche, you know, social networks would flourish based upon their technology.
It does. You know, LinkedFA, the CEO, says we're nothing like LinkedIn, but in a sense they are. However, they're a closed social network. They are a business network, but they're closed. Mm-hmm. So maybe LinkedIn has some plan to launch a closed version of their network for regulated industries. Who knows? But obviously there's some kind of threat there. There are tons and tons of companies out there that use the word linked in their business name.
Right. It's not just a matter of the term linked. This is a bigger issue. This is a business issue, a threat, as you're saying.
Exactly. So you can find the article about it. I'll put a link in the show notes, but it's on the LinkedFA blog. The CEO wrote a post about it. So yeah, that's basically what I've seen in the news this week. Not a whole lot.
Just as a derivative of that, I mean, that's actually one of the threats for investing in a social network as an advisor, as anybody who wants to use a social network, is that the social network takes sort of a mandated view and moves in a direction away from some of its users. I'm not saying LinkedIn's doing that, but that there's always that potential out there. So, you know, you just have to beware.
Yeah, I do think, you know, whenever a business launches, they start big, and then when the money to be made there has been made, they move to more niche opportunities. So I believe that even, you know, Facebook is huge, 750 million users. LinkedIn has 100 million users. At some point in time, I do think we will see these networks offer more niche opportunities for really communicating within your industry or something along those lines. And perhaps that's a threat, but at some point they're going to have to continue to generate revenue. So the riches are in the niches, right?
Riches in the niches.
Riches in the niches. So.
So speaking of niches.
Yes.
How's that for a segue?
Great.
So one of the things we thought we would talk about on this call has to do with I guess subscription content. We can call it newsletter content, but the idea is subscription. Whether you charge money for it or you don't, this is not free and open public information. This is something that would require an email address, right?
Right. So newsletters, right, is probably the term that most financial advisors would be familiar with.
Yeah. The reason I sort of talk about subscription content is I think that, you know, we can talk about it more in depth, but it's the newsletter itself is evolving as a medium, right? So it's actually becoming more interactive.
Totally.
But definitely if we talk about, you know, this was the same type of newsletter that, you know, brokerages would send out to their clients once a month, once a quarter, you know, with some information about the markets, maybe a little bit about the account, and maybe a little bit of personalization from the broker himself. You know, a lot of that activity, which was once sent via the post, hardcover, is now, you know, being delivered online.
Yeah, and you're killing me with that word broker.
Okay, sorry.
I'm just kidding. It makes my ears bleed.
Okay.
No, I'm just teasing you.
Well, now I know where to bother you.
Now you know my pet peeve.
I'm Sirius 7 also, and I can use it, and I don't, I have no trouble sleeping.
There you go, I'm Sirius 7 now. Yeah, so this whole concept of newsletter, a subscription newsletter has evolved, and there are various opportunities for reaching clients and prospects and advocates and centers of influence and being able to cultivate those relationships through a regular newsletter. Now, there are different formats, obviously, which we'll talk about, but I was jumping around in some LinkedIn groups this week, some financial advisor-based groups, and I saw a question about an advisor had posted about, you know, he wanted to set up and start a regular newsletter with clients. He didn't specify if it was going to be print or email. And then, you know, who did anyone have any advice or guidance about a service provider? And basically he said, I don't want to write any of it. I want it all to be done for me. And I don't know. I mean, I'd like to talk about maybe the pros and cons, first of all, let's talk about why a newsletter makes sense in the first place, especially from an email standpoint, an email newsletter.
Well, I sort of think of it as the next stage in a relationship, right, where, you know, putting a blog out there is somewhat arm's length distance from the people reading it, gives a chance, you know, for the reader or the casual browser to sort of feel you out as a prospective service provider. Offering a newsletter then sort of takes it to the next level. It's like, you know, asking your prospect out on a date or them asking you out. Where it says, you know, I'm committing now by giving you a piece of my information. In return, I'm gonna enter into a sort of a more direct relationship with you. And the newsletter, the periodicity of a newsletter, you're able to sort of drip content out at specific intervals. And it seems to be the way internet marketers use, you know, to go from it's a sales funnel essentially. It's a general browser to people who are more interested in your product. They sign up for a newsletter, and then through the newsletter, you can then move to, you know, to even a higher level of the relationship, maybe getting a phone call together, inviting the person to a seminar. But that's sort of the standard mechanism for moving through that process.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the email address is still gold. And in fact, with our bloggers on the Wired Advisor platform, the number one goal of blogging is to capture the lead, capture the email address, get the visitor or the prospect's permission to stay in touch with them in a more direct fashion, where you can really cultivate that relationship. And
you said something really important there. You called them the visitor moving to a prospect, and I think that's what getting them to sign up does, right?
Exactly. It's the funnel, and the blog is. I view a blog as kind of a top of the funnel marketing tool. Because you've got to capture that lead in order to go deeper with the relationship. You've got to be able to capture that email. And arguably, you can also go deeper now and engage if you connect with those people out in the social networking communities, right? But ultimately, the email is still at the top of the food chain. It's still important, because here's the thing. And I'll talk more about some key takeaways for improving email marketing performance that I learned from a webinar that I was on. But people are reading their emails like crazy on their mobile phones. So, you know, there was some talk for a while about email marketing just being dead, but you have to remember everything's going mobile. So, and people sort of view email like homework. They need to get through it. They it's like that unopened present, you know. But a lot of times your emails aren't going to get opened either. So there's some give and take there.
That's a great point. I mean, there's nothing like receiving. You know, there was even talk that Facebook would sort of disintermediate the whole email thing, where people would be messaging through the social networks, and we would never need email. Like, my kids don't even use email; they use Facebook. But there's nothing like getting it, you know, a semi-personalized email where it's the exact type of content I like. You know, I get it when I expect it, and it says, "Hi, Zach." You know, and it's like, you know, even though I know it's not personal, it was sent out through a software program. There's some emails that I get that I've opted into that I really look forward to every week.
Yeah, I agree. Especially if, and let's talk about this, if it's good content. If it's valuable,
all boils down to good content.
Yeah, if you're providing valuable content, I just don't know if a have it done for you ghostwritten content really accomplishes anything but a waste of time.
There's some standardized, you know, software packages, service packages, I should say, that were, you know, for advisors, where that you can take something off the shelf. And it's already, you know, FINRA compliant. You just put your name and your picture on it and you send it out. that solves one of the goals. That's sort of that periodic, you know, touch point with your end client or end prospect. But it doesn't do that other part where you're actually serving them with some type of engaging content, as you're describing.
True. It does allow you to be visible, right? Mm-hmm. On a regular basis. And, you know, I remember mailing out one of those paper newsletters as a financial advisor to hundreds of prospects over and over and over every single month, and actually opening doors with that newsletter and being able to bring in some client relationships. However, I always made sure that I wrote the lead article. You know, we were allowed to write one article. So I think at the very least, if you can do that, but you know, I've been put on a bunch of financial advisor email marketing lists, which really infuriates me. If somebody does not opt into your list, you shouldn't add them, you know? And so I get all these emails that these advisors have just added me to. And
I mean, in general, you unsubscribe, right?
I unsubscribe every time.
You can add as many people as you want. They start getting this email, this foreign email, you know, that they didn't opt in for. They're going to unsubscribe, and they're going to even, you know, they may describe you as spam, which will hurt your ability to deliver emails in the future.
Exactly. And I can tell you that 90% of them are totally stock articles. And it's terrible. So I'm not a big fan of using that ghostwritten content unless it's something you can customize with your own personality for your own target markets, and you know, where you can actually be the author. Because I think if you put other stamps, a stamp of the ghostwriting firm, then you just don't. I don't know. There's just not a lot of credibility in that. That's my personal opinion. There are a lot of great services out there. And also, you know, services like Morningstar, they offer an advisor newsletter for clients. Well, they're a reputable research firm. You know, they've got some really great information. But I think it needs to at least be a combo of your own personal insights in addition to maybe some stock content.
I totally agree with that. So we talked about some of the reasons why somebody would want to use it. It's taking somebody from being a browser, a casual browser, into somebody who becomes an active prospect. Do you want to talk about techniques now?
Sure.
About deliverability, about composing, how you come up with content at a high level.
Sure. Yeah.
Are you going to use the same type of content you're using on your blog? How do you differentiate that?
I think there are a couple ways to use blog content. I don't know why you wouldn't use it. You can't assume that everybody's seeing it, even if they're subscribed to it. So obviously you can set up a subscription to where every time you post a new article or video or what have you on your blog, it can be delivered in the form of an email newsletter. And in fact, MailChimp, Zach, which you and I are very familiar with and have used a lot, which is an email marketing provider, or platform, you can do that. It's called RSS to email. So every time you post a new article to your blog, it can be delivered automatically to your list, and you can brand the email to look like your blog. So it's pretty neat. Mm-hmm. I would say that would be the lowest maintenance option. Above that, I've seen even some of our bloggers develop what they call a monthly e-zine. And not only does it have information about events that they may be hosting for the month or things going on in the local community, but they also link to various articles that were posted on their blog over the past month or even over the past 6 months. You know, popular content you can link back to in your newsletter, back to your blog. So why not repurpose work that you've already put time into, right?
Right. So, and just actually the sending of that, does that take a lot of time? Like to load that up in one of these, like a MailChimp or an email service provider?
Well, what do you think? I mean, we've both done it a million times.
Right. I mean, and I think there's a learning curve. I mean, I get faster at it the more I do it.
Right.
But it's a manual process. It takes somebody going in and loading it up with content. making making sure you proofread the content before it goes out, and then monitoring sort of the analytics after you've sent it out to see that's the greatest part about email marketing, is that you get instant feedback about whether are people opening your email, are they reading your email, are they clicking on the links in the email, much better than a blog, I feel like.
Right, and even the even what they show with regard to the open rates, aren't always all that accurate, because whether or not you've opened an email is defined differently. You could just preview it in a preview pane and it's considered to be open. But I think more importantly, the clicks, where are people clicking on the links that you put inside of the email newsletter? What areas of interest are they drawn to? And that's a good way to gauge if your content in your email newsletter is resonating with your target audience.
So is there something about too much conversation? Can you be over emailing client potential clients or clients?
When I listened to this again, HubSpot, which I know we've talked about them before, and that they're a great resource. They do a lot of research on social media engagement and even email marketing as well. I'll tell you a couple of things that I got out of their. They did a survey, and they analyzed. They did it in conjunction with MailChimp. Okay, and they looked at 9.5 billion emails to come up with this. Wow. 9.5 billion emails that were sent through the MailChimp email service.
And I think again, I get half of those.
Yeah, and again, MailChimp is clearly a self-service option. It is going to take time. It is cumbersome. Yes, you can build your template, but you've got to go in and fill in your and format your content every time. So it's not a quick and easy process, really, to be honest. But some of the key takeaways were, I mentioned this earlier, people tend to treat email like homework. It's a chore, but they must go through it. They talk about sending emails on the weekends. Click-through rates are higher on Saturday and Sunday.
That's interesting. I wouldn't have suspected that.
Exactly. Yeah. That's very interesting. Don't send emails on Mondays or Tuesdays. Those are the highest unsubscribe days. Send emails early in the morning. And, sometimes you can't control that. It depends on what kind of email program you've got set up and as to when they'll be sent out. Like if you set up an RSS to email through your blog where each new blog post goes out as an email, you have to choose a time each day that you want it to grab the feed and send the email. But I guess you can choose the time there, so you could do it early morning.
Right, and MailChimp has a function called Time Warp where you can actually describe per time zone when it should be delivered.
Oh, that's true.
I use that, and I find that's very effective.
That is true. Then it says make sure you render your emails for mobile phones. So a very high percentage of people read email on their mobile devices, their iPhones, their Blackberries. I totally believe that's true. And I also think that, fancy email templates with lots of graphics, I'm becoming more of a fan of going back to the old just text version emails. To get attention and make sure your email gets read. I think having too many graphics in there now because of mobile devices sort of makes it clunky.
So no graphics and don't use the word broker.
There you go. There you go, Zach.
And I do think that there's a movement. You can see some of the templates within MailChimp that some of the newer templates and periodically all the systems release new templates. They're getting basic and more simple. Simplified, I should say, where it's very clean and not very graphics laden. I think those have better deliverability and easier access. People can read them easier. They don't want to be, it's like having an ad thrust in front of you. Just, give the text, very simple. And just as an aside, I'm sorry to cut you off, it's worth a whole show on this. I've been spending a lot of time reading, copywriting. We've mentioned it before on some of our earlier shows. But as much as copywriting, plays a role in your blog content, it really plays a role in email content. So it's very important to make sure you get your message down very tightly.
I agree. I think publishing is the new prospecting. Whether you're publishing on a blog, whether you're publishing in an email, you need to get good at it, or you need to hire somebody on your team who really understands you and your market and your business and have them write for you or along with you. Be able to communicate your message very well. I'll put a link to this article, but just another thing that was in here is serialize and label your emails, such as use the word digest or edition. That works well.
To make it feel like there's some type of continuity?
I think so. And the more links you have in your email, the more clicks you will get. That's another one.
Okay.
So anyway, some interesting stuff. And I'll tell you, I have been recently experimenting with Infusionsoft. Are you familiar with them?
Yes. You want to tell everybody a little bit about who they are?
Yeah, Infusionsoft is a platform for small businesses that incorporates a number of various applications under one platform, and such as email marketing, automation. In other words, you can really track what people click, and you can tag them and put them in different groups and start them on a different series of emails, so you can really get to know your email readership and what their interests are. They've also got a client relationship manager built in, so CRM. They've got the ability to do e-commerce, invoicing, that kind of thing. And it's expensive. I think it starts at $199 a month. But
right, and a MailChimp is something like, you know, at 500 people and you're like, you know, 500 to 1,000, like $15 a month, right?
Absolutely. I haven't completely committed to using Infusionsoft, but I will tell you that I'm impressed. And the thing about it is you've got to spend some time learning the platform. There is a huge, huge learning curve. And the guys over there told me for a while they eliminated their mentoring program. So what they used to do is when they would bring on a new customer, they would do like 7 to 10 hours of training, one-on-one training with those customers to get them familiar with the system and help them at least set up their first sequence or their first program for email. And they did away with that, and their retention rates for new customers went from 85 to 90% and dropped down to like 40%. They just lost people after the first, you know, within the first 30 days. They were losing tons of business because it is a monthly, you know, it's a pay-as-you-go deal. But now they also have an upfront payment. So they brought it back. They brought back the coaching part.
I mean, you're sort of paying them to help them set it up for you, right?
Exactly. And it's more of a facilitated or guided learning process. So they're not doing it for you, but you're on GoToMeeting calls and you're screen sharing and you're learning how to walk through the steps. And I'm telling you, I've walked through the steps now 3 or 4 times and I still don't remember. You know, I still have to get on with my mentor and now remind me, now how does this work? Even though I've taken copious notes. So it is not easy. It's a very hard program to learn, but you know, I see a lot of very successful marketers using it, which continued to pique my curiosity. And so we'll see. I would say that the jury is still out on it, but I'm very impressed. It's so powerful. I just hope that it's not too overwhelmingly powerful that, you know, you quit using it because it's too difficult type of thing.
I mean, it really is sort of the holy grail, being able to tie together all your different systems from your website to your email list, and being able to segment, you know, those hot prospects out there, then to, you know, to be able to deliver them a different message than you would somebody who's just walking in the door. That's extremely powerful.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's an awesome tool. I think they have like 7,000 members using their product. So, boy, they've built a really great business. The users of their product are evangelists. They just swear by it. You know, they just love it. So, but you know, you're going to also now pay up front, for Infusionsoft because you're paying for that mentoring and that coaching. So I think it's $2,000 up front, which I ended up, getting a good deal cause I just talked the guy down, so I think they have some room in that pricing, obviously. So I don't know if it's a solution for financial advisors, but it's pretty cool.
Very interesting.
Yeah. So, well, we've been going on and on here for a while now. It's probably a good time to wrap up, unless you have something else, Zach, that you'd like to throw out there.
I just know what words not to use in the future. no, I think we did a good job on this one.
Okay, well, I'd also like to again thank Arcovi.com, social media compliance archiving for financial professionals and firms. They're very gracious to sponsor Advisor Go Radio, and we love our sponsors. So thanks again to Arcovi, and Zach, we'll see you next week.
See you, Steph.
Take care.